Hello, welcome back to another edition of ASBN Scrum Reset. It's Sam Bruce and Christy Doran here to wrap up. Christy, well, I think a pretty good super app, really. The third iteration of this particular concept in Melbourne. Look, there weren't too many more spectators there at Amy Park, which was unfortunate because what we got were five really good games of rugby and a hell of a warning from the Chiefs.
You're right, great super round. The only disappointment really, and it's sorry to say for those from Melbourne or Victoria that are besotted to the Rebels, but it was just a terrible look that it was in Melbourne, unfortunately, and it will be the last time it's played there. I have no doubt about that. It's not confirmed, but it should be, and it needs to go somewhere either Brisbane, Sydney, or New Zealand. Bullaround and Fiji would be amazing. I just, from a logistical perspective, can't see it happening. But hats off to the rugby. The action on the field was superb. Couple of upsets. Moana Pacific brought it. Second week in a row. Really enjoyed the footy.
So did I. Fantastic. And it was one of those weekends where, as an Australian, you weren't going to be too disappointed if you got two or three out of six, as it was looking like there. For a little while, I certainly missed Moana. As you said, they're mighty impressive the first 2 weeks. Could have beaten the Highlanders last week as well, but fully deserved their win over the Drua on Saturday. But if we start with the big Aussie win of the weekend, Christy, Saturday night, the Waratahs over the Crusaders. Now, I got on the Waratahs a couple of years ago at Leichhardt, you might remember, at $13. When I saw the $8 price last week, I thought, you know, it's probably worth a bet. And then I thought about more about the Reds game and how good the Crusaders were in that second half against the Chiefs. I thought, I just don't think they've got that in them this time. But couldn't have been more wrong. And I guess the big focus here was how they recovered after that early try. I just thought, wow, this could get ugly from the outset. And the exact opposite turned out.
It was less than 90 seconds, wasn't it? And you see Marcus Springer just racing down the left-hand touchline. I thought, oh dear, here we go again. This could be a long afternoon. But I was always thinking that the Crusaders would be able to overrun the Tars in the last 20 minutes. And that's where I was concerned. I thought, you know what, first 60 minutes, brand new halves combination for the Crusaders. I think that there'll be a couple of teething issues, and I thought that the Tars would be in it. I just didn't think that they would be able to withstand that large and big press from the Crusaders when they bring on a Joe Moody. They brought on
Ryan Crotty.
Ryan Crotty. Owen Franks was the person I was looking for as well. Mitch Drummond, and he was someone who was supposed to close out the game. But the great defensive pressure. They were right in the contest the whole time, and they took their chances, didn't they? And Tane Edmund, take your cap off to him. That was a very, very good display off the back of that defensive blunder. Right up from the opening kind of line break down that left touchline when he bit in and needed to stay out.
Yeah, I read that in your piece this morning, Christy, on the Roar, and I'd forgotten about that because I think it was such a bad miss, wasn't it? A bad read, but you're right. The way he recovered from there was just superb, and I love the line, self-deprecating line with Stan Sport in the post-match around. Well, I'm not blessed with much athletic ability, but what I do is I just play direct and straighten things up. And I was thinking about this over the weekend, probably after that game, and trying to kind of pinpoint, are there Joe Schmidt players we think we can pick out so far? Guys who played under him for Ireland for so long. Now, you wouldn't say that Johnny Sexton was the most brilliant, naturally gifted number 10 out there. Great kicking game, fair passing game, but what he did was just control games really well. Sat in the pocket there a lot of the time and used the quality that he had around them. Is Tane Edmund, is he in the mix for this Wallabies number 10 jersey later this year? Obviously, we don't want to read too much into one performance, and that extends to the Waratahs as well, who must back it up this week against the Highlanders. But the two tries he set up just was threatening all game purely by, you know, as he said, just playing direct, squaring up and committing to the line and seeing what he could poke his head through from there.
Yeah, what Johnny Sexton also was a great organiser. And that we've kind of seen glimpses of Tane Edmund in the past. It's funny you ask that question right from the top. It's a very, very valid one, I think. And it's one of those ones where you're thinking in terms of a power rankings of 10s, Bernard Foley's troubled by concussions at the moment. He's not going to make a comeback. He's in Japan. Wade Cooper's 35, turning 36. He's not going to be in the picture either. We know that from early on, Joe Schmidt has every opportunity said the strong preference is I'll pick from home. I won't be looking abroad. I had opportunities in Ireland to do that. We didn't do that. We picked players in Ireland that were based on shore. And I think you'll do largely the same thing in Australia. There might be one or two exceptions. Back to Kane. My boss, Tony Harper, who spoke to me last week, said, what about Tane Edmund? He's fallen off the cliff. He was being, you know, spoken about as a Wallabies player 18 months ago. Can you write a story about what's going on? And this was about 5 days ago, before the match. And I said, you know what? He's fallen off the radar because he had an injury played 2023, back issues, barely got on the park. But he also went on the Australia A tour to Japan. But the Wallabies, Dave Rennie and the Wallabies environment saw Ben Donaldson ahead of Tade Edmund. The TARS saw it the other way. They thought that Tane was in front of Ben Donaldson. They were surprised when Ben got the nod. What we've seen over the game against the Crusaders, and we saw it 2 years ago against the Crusaders as well, is Tane has a level head, an ability to get up the games, and some of those characteristics that you were just talking about with Johnny Sexton. There's a long way to go before you're ever that kind of figure. I'm not sure if you'll ever get there, but he's a guy that at 23, 24, a couple of years further down that path than the likes of a Tom Liner, a Carter Gordon, perhaps, because he's just been battle-hardened through shoot shield. He's then made the leap. He's had an injury setback, and this is a really promising start from Tane. He's one to keep an eye on for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting the shoot shield line you mentioned there, Christy. He's not a guy that's come straight out of school into the academy and then debuted sort of in the next 1 to 2 years after that. He has had to perform for Eastwood now over a number of years. You mentioned last year with the injuries, got stuck behind Ben Donaldson. I think came back for that quarter final and started at 10 when Donaldson shifted to 15. But there's also a lot of merit in playing two of your best games against the Crusaders, I think. If you can step up and perform against the big dogs of the competition like that, he has now done twice. It's got to count for a lot. So a fine performance from Tane now, but as we've said, is the... it's necessary for him now to back that up over the coming weeks, and if the Waratahs are going to extend with an extension for Coach Darren Coleman, he's going to be right in the thick of that from number 10. What about elsewhere in that team? I guess in the performance, Christy, the line-out was really exceptional, wasn't it? It disrupted a lot of Crusader ball, and they were uncharacteristically off too. Drop balls from Havili and Scott Barrett there at the finish, which was Tane Edmund's hand again getting in to knock that ball. And you kind of felt if they'd scored there, they had another one in them. I know Darren Coleman was squirming in his seat there in the final 2 or 3 minutes, but they held on well. And elsewhere around the park, I mean, young Harry Wilson was good, Joey Walton, these guys who are starting to get just that little bit more footy into them now. It's only going to help with their depth when guys like Parisi come back and hopefully for Keddie at some stage as well this year. Jed Holloway was back to his best, making a real nuisance of himself around the paddock. There was any number of performers that really stood up in what was a collective team effort.
Yeah, you're right. You look right across the board, and there wasn't just a couple of players. There was a bunch of players. You made mention of the try saver from Tane on Scott Barrett. The other try saver was, of course, when he ran back and managed to keep and even stay and perhaps even better, Sever Reese. So there was Jed Holloway, so disruptive at the line-out. The defensive line-out's always been a strength of his game, particularly the last couple of years, and he took that to new heights against the Crusaders. So we've got to say they're in a bit of trouble. You look at the injury list that they've got as well, when they're missing a Will Jordan. We know that Cody Taylor's out for quite a while because he's having a bit of a sabbatical break. Comes at an average time for them, and their replacement Hooker really struggled, I thought. It's the little one percenters that went a long way on the weekend, and got efforts like Hugh Sinclair with the charge down. How often do you just see a player coast through that or turn away a half-hearted effort? But no, he charged it down, scored the try, managed to beat David Havili, I think, to the ball there. That was a huge moment. But it was smart decision-making, taking shots at goal early, getting on the scoreboard, those sorts of one percenters, Australia typically doesn't, Australian teams typically don't do very well. And they did that much better. I thought that they'd burned an opportunity to put more points on the board to go to 19 late in the half. They turned down shots, went for the try. They didn't come get it originally, but a pretty poor exit from the Crusaders halfback allowed Tane Edmund to run to the line, break the line, and put Harry Wilson away. The centre combination was a really good one. I thought Joey Walton, big boot, he and Tane Edmund's clearing kicks inside their 22 were superb. It's probably the best I've seen Australia's sides clear their own lines in a long, long time. It's a really problematic area for the sevens teams and the 15s teams exiting off the back of scoring points. So really pleasing performance. They've got to back it up, though, don't they? They've got the Highlanders this weekend, and we know that off the back of last year, the reason why Darren Coleman went into the game under a lot of pressure is because the Waratahs were poor against the Brumbies in their opener with 20,000 plus at the SFS last year for their opening game. And then they bookended it terribly by dropping the final home game against Moana Pacifica, which was Moana's first win of the season. So that left a really sour taste in the mouth of a lot of people, which was Michael Hooper's farewell game from in Sydney, as it turned out, in 15th full stop. So big, big moment this weekend for Darren Coleman's Tars to make it back-to-back against a Highlander side, which is reasonable, but definitely there for the taking, I think.
Yeah, I think they're still the weakest of the New Zealand teams, despite a couple of wins in the preseason. Mahe Vaiolano working back alongside Ahmed there too. To get back in that reset. And maybe that's the difference in this Waratahs team. You've got three guys there trying to get back and scramble defensively to ensure Sivu doesn't score that try. So a big win for the Waratahs, a big win for Darren Coleman, but will mean nothing unless they back it up on Friday night. As you said, Jake Gordon, just quickly again, I mean, I don't know if there's another player out there that probably empties the tank as much as he does week in, week out. And there's still massive concerns, I think, over his pass. It's probably potentially the weakest now, I think, of any of the Australian nines. But he's just so busy around the park, isn't he? Those loose balls he jumped on two brilliantly the other night. A little brother actually commented he looks a bit like Crash Bandicoot when he runs. For those late 90s, early 2000s gaming enthusiasts out there. I think he's the ideal leader for that team, isn't he? But how he figures going forward from a test perspective as well, if he's overlooked this year, you do wonder. I'm sure there'll be any number of teams overseas that would love to have a Jake Gordon in their team just for the sheer will and effort he puts into the game each week.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a number of Waratahs players, Jake Gordon included, that are buying up spots overseas. And I say that also for the fact that Jake Gordon's got a partner now, but also he missed out on that opportunity at Toulon. Went over there, wanted to have a crack, wanted to play a handful of matches, a couple of months there, and that got cut short because of concussion issues. And I don't know if it's actually necessarily been put out there yet, but Jake Gordon was very close to going to the World Cup last year as a late call up, and the medical team had been speaking to him about how he is, and he was a bit like, what's going on here? But it was because Eddie Jones was considering a late call up for him.
There you go. We shall see. Let's go to the Reds and Canes yesterday afternoon, Sunday afternoon. That is, it was a hell of a game. This one too, wasn't it? Really, kind of ding dong back and forth. You score, we score throughout the 80 minutes, and then 5, 6, 7 minutes out of what is it of extra time. So I think the two big things that stood out for me in this game and certainly the Brumbies Chiefs as well was just the sheer physicality of these two New Zealand sides, Chiefs in particular, which we'll come to shortly. But this, while it was a loss for the Reds, you kind of almost feel like their stock certainly didn't deteriorate, may have even gone up slightly because they went toe-to-toe. They had some injury and concussion issues. They lost a few players along the way, but their maul's working really well. They seem to be in sync with how they want to play the game with each other. Wilson and McWright combining very well again. There was still a lot to like about this performance, and they most certainly deserved a losing bonus point out of it.
You're right. Their stock actually, I completely agree with you. I think it went up. The issue is that it was a massive missed opportunity. And I say that because wins against New Zealand sides, we know, are very, very precious. But off the back of a good win against the Tars, to go back-to-back before hosting the Chiefs would have been really, really important. And you look at the run of games that they've got, and they're not easy. As I say, it's the Chiefs next weekend in round three. That's followed by a return back to Melbourne to take on the Rebels, who, if they can get past Moana Pacifica in the third match, the Rebels would find some confidence. You know, they're definitely not the full part. They're not operating on full cylinders at the moment, but there's enough in that squad to challenge. And then a trip to Perth before hosting the Brumbies, and that's then followed by a bye. So I just thought it was a huge opportunity missed to get some confidence, to just ensure that everything that they're doing at the moment, it's like solidified. They know that they're on the right track. They know that what's happening under Les Kiss, the revolution under Les Kiss just continues. But we can't discount the fact that they played well for the large majority of it. I could totally take your point about the physicality, the step up that it takes against New Zealand teams. And the Hurricanes always bring that right across the field. Asafa Moore leads that charge in the front row, but it extends out to the Geordie Barretts and the Proctors in the midfield. Cam Roygaard always ever present, sniffing that opportunity to take a snipe, and he did that really well on the weekend. I was impressed by the likes of Zane Nongal just holding up that scrum. He didn't look out of place. They kept it tight. And even the Reds in the 20 minutes leading up to halftime, they kept it really tight down the blind side, down that short side. They weren't scared about going back. And that was, there was a bit of a Joe Schmidt Irish feel to that. And we know that Les Kiss spent a fair bit of time with Joe Schmidt there. And that was something that the Reds haven't done. I'm not sure if they've done it for years. I don't think they did it under Brad Thorne. That was a nice bit of evolution in their play as well.
Yeah, Zane Nongor, actually, I thought it was probably one of the better games I've seen him play. And there was certainly a lot of heat coming on at scrum time, but I just thought he really looked up for the physical fight. Wasn't making, many metres, but was certainly putting his head up for carry after carry. So a player that was, probably fortunate to be on that World Cup trip last year and only be there because of a couple of injuries, but maybe a massive confidence boost for him just being a part of that experience last year. Geordie Barrett, mate, you've got to think he'll miss 2 to 4 weeks depending on his record and early guilty plea and tackling school and whatever else we're dealing with at the judiciary these days. But no excuse there. That was a bad shot.
Yeah. And it looked bad from the outset. And Geordie Barrett might not have been running forward, but Geordie Pataia certainly was. And it was, you saw it from the outset, and I'm glad that it was pulled up pretty quickly. I've got to say, I was surprised that Pataia was allowed to stay on the field for as long as he was. That was a bit of an oversight. And yes, the right outcome happens, but he managed to play for a couple more minutes, despite very obviously showing some concussion symptoms by laying prone for a wee while. And yeah, I think Barrett will miss a few weeks in his 100th game. And I also think that the Reds are going to have now a bit of a shuffle in their back line. Can't see Pataia now backing up to play next week. Hunter Paisami's had concussion issues in the past. So perhaps that brings in Isaac Henry, a bit of a stronger kind of another guy that can break the line inside centre. And at fullback, it seems pretty obvious that a Jock Campbell would slide in from the wing to fullback to cover that. But there's some injury concerns there for the Reds against coming up against the Chiefs, who are humming, that look fit. And they too actually look like they'll lose one of their replacement props for a high shot on Caden Neville. That looks pretty nasty itself.
It did. Before we jump to that game completely, a couple of lighter moments in the closing match of Super Round. Tom Liner finding the back of Sarah Uru's head, a classic home team Falcon, which you don't see a lot of, but always worth a giggle. And Suliasi Vernu's couple of, certainly one attempt at a clearing kick under pressure. Didn't leave much to be desired, did it? Joe Schmidt, I think he probably likes his wingers to be able to kick somehow. I don't know that he's as fascinated with rugby league as perhaps one E. Jones was.
Well, what I'll say as well, it was missed at the moment. Fraser McWright probably was a little bit lucky not to give away a penalty early in that golden point for a high shot. As it turned out, Reds managed to get a ball. It might have actually been on the stroke of full time of regular time, but there was no doubt that the Hurricanes got away with one in golden point when the replacement loose forward Vivini Lasaka, I think his name is, he was in an offside position when Cormac Daly picks up the ball for a pick and go, and the replacement Hurricanes loose forward definitely should have been penalised on around the 10-metre mark. Instead, the Hurricanes get the ball for Daly not releasing, holding on, and they go, obviously, kick for touch, and they score shortly after. So that was a big moment. You would have backed Tom Liner to nail that over from 40 metres out. They're the tiny little margins in these games, Brucey.
Absolutely, absolutely. The margin wasn't tight nor tiny. Earlier on Sunday, the Chiefs were just awesome, I thought, against the Brumbies, who, as Ryan Lonergan said post-match, missed the jump. But I don't even think that the Chiefs let them turn up for the jump because they were brilliant from the outset. The sheer physicality, as we said earlier, the power, the continuity that they played with. They just, Xavier Rowe and Damian McKenzie, it was brilliant again. They just had a dream platform to play off, didn't they? It was front foot ball virtually around the clock, save from a couple of, bits of Corey Toole magic. But the Brumbies were smashed at the breakdown. They were smashed at the contact area. It felt like every time the Chiefs carried, there was sort of 2 or 3 metres through contact. They couldn't physically assert themselves on the Chiefs at all, the Brumbies defensively. And they were gone at halftime, really. And I think you noted that in Steve Larkham's interview with Stan there just after halftime when he said, well, we know this is a long season ahead. We've just got to treat this half in isolation almost. But it really didn't get any better. They were beaten up and beaten up badly. And I think there's some probably real question marks around the physicality of this Brumbies team. Maybe in the post Laurie Fisher era, I don't know if that's fair. I know you were talking with Laurie on the Rural Pod last week, but it just didn't feel like that Brumbies team we've come to expect at that area of the game, that they could be so badly beaten physically and around the tackle.
Yeah, I text Laurie Fisher during that game. He got back to me shortly after and said, that's one to forget, forget it completely, because nothing went right. And even from the opening whistle, Nick Frost spilling the opening kickoff, and he spilled it backwards, but it led to Chiefs getting a line out, and although I think it was Frosty that got up to manage to steal the line out, they just looked troubled all game. You've summed it up in terms of losing the physicality battle, but that resulted in Brumbies losing their shape, their structure, and balls were being pushed. There was nothing went right. And I was surprised that Ollie Satsford started at 12. I know that he's had a few raps recently. To me, he's not the answer for the Brumbies at 12. We know that in this modern age, more often than not, having a bigger 12 helps lay the platform, both defensively and offensively. And I would have had Tamati Tua there. I don't think he's a world beater Tua, but what he does allow is you to get some front foot board, and he's going to put his head down and just run straight. And Satsford a couple of times, little wraparounds that didn't work, pop passes. That doesn't happen. You don't win games of rugby when you're on the back foot and you're getting slow ball by going out the back. You've got to go through the middle, and the Chiefs did that really, really well, right from 1 to 15. And the thing that surprised me, two of the things that surprised me, one, the Brumbies, how flat they were, given that the Chiefs beat them last year's semi-final. But secondly, you take out Brody Retallick, Peter Gasolakula, Sam Kane, Sammy Onitokiyahu came off the bench, and yet the Chiefs still had an unbelievably physical pack that dominated a Brumbies side that was missing really only Alan Alatoa, and Darcy Swain is probably going to be reintroduced over the next week or two after a little injury. That surprised me. the worst performance, I think, from Stephen Larkham, from a Brumby side coached by Stephen Larkham, in both his first coaching tenure there and second, I think. Much worse than the last, the defeat to the Falls last year, where there was about 1,000 people rested for the game.
Yeah, hard to disagree with that. One moment I do want to discuss with you, mate. The stoppage that was created by James Dolman, who is not my favourite referee out there. But in this case, you know, I was happy enough for him to call Ryan Lonergan up for not using the ball there. I think you're right in saying there could have been any number of other instances across the weekend, and I certainly counted one or two from the Chiefs later in that match that shouldn't have been called. And I've got no issue with that, as long as it's consistency. Let's have it as, you know, lying in the tackle, a few of the tackle lying in, that's going to be a focal point, then make this a listed focal point as well. But just thinking about it then, once this, because it was the first time that I've seen it called for such a long time, but the actual sanction is counterproductive to the law itself, because we're then stopping the game, taking 30 to 45 seconds probably to get the two forward backs together to set a scrum. So by stopping the game, we're actually then stopping it for longer than we should have. Is there a rethink on this law that maybe, and I know there was the release that came out of the World Rugby meetings last week around trying to speed the game up, and I can't remember the exact terminology, but it was a very rugby way of saying we're in the entertainment business. I'll have to go and dig it out, because it was just call it what it is. But anyway, a way of reducing the intention, not that we're going to do this, but, you know, open discussions around the ability to, I guess, take scrums in certain situations. Now, for me, that would be a perfect situation just to have a free kick. You can't have a scrum. It's a tap and go or up and under, whatever you want to do. But by just calling a scrum, it just goes against the whole ethos of that particular law.
It's a great point, Brucey, and this is why you should be on the World Rugby Commission. There's no doubt about it. A great point, well articulated. I think the thing that frustrated, it's the first I can remember since Ryan Lawrence, I think, was pinged for the Rebels against the Force last year very early in the season, and people were kind of scratching their head going, wow, this is a bit of a refreshing change. But to me, the inconsistency right the way through the weekend, and I watched every game, did four match reports from the six matches, and particularly on the Friday, there were so many examples where that could have been that could have taken place. To wait until a Sunday, to me, it smacks of a referee who's looking at how do I get all more international fixtures, because James Dolan might be clear in his communication, generally speaking, but I think he's the sort of referee that comes out and tries to do things in his own volition at times to get World Rugby to take notice. And that's how often it's box-ticking exercises. Right idea, but even if you look at that example, Lonergan had, there was a pretty good tackle. The ball hadn't even been really touched by Lonergan when he started to try to move it back, and he said, use it now. It was the wrong timing to use it, and I accept that it did take a few seconds to get the ball back, but it wasn't one of those ones which takes 10 seconds where he's taken 5 seconds to start the process of kicking it back and where that caterpillar ruck kind of starts to form. It was the last little extra second where Lonergan popped his head up to look at the covering defence on the short side that spooked him a little bit, but yeah, I wasn't a fan of that moment at time, but I completely agree with you, Brucey. That would be, and it was a big moment. Chiefs score straight off the back of it, but great moment to highlight there going forward, and a really nice solution about trying to speed up the game.
I'll tell you the other thing. It just surprised me, and maybe I didn't notice it last week because it was such a thrilling close game between the Crusaders and the Chiefs, but to me, it looks like both Atene Nanai Satoru and Sean Stevenson are bigger this year. They're not just, you know, quick and fleet-footed and have got brilliant footwork, but they look like they might be sort of 2, 3, 4 kilos heavier or bulkier this year. I could have that wrong, but just going by the naked eye, they look in a team that was so physically dominant, as we said, they look just as powerful as some of the forwards.
They're getting older as well. I probably tend to agree with you. I think I noticed that with Nanai Satoru, and didn't he just carve up the Brumbies defence? Some magic there with Damian McKenzie, but Shaun Stevenson as well, another who just continues to impress. And you wonder whether or not those two will feature under Scott Robertson. I can certainly see Stevenson playing a part. And will Jordan's injury troubles perhaps mean that a Stevenson comes more into the reckoning than perhaps he might otherwise?
Cool. All right, let's jump back to Friday night, mate. Come from behind win from the Rebels over the Force in what was another really entertaining game, as we said. Carter Gordon, look, he's something, isn't he? You shake your head, and I wrote a piece on this for ESPN today, kind of the 2 minutes that, to me, it kind of identifies, underlines, if you like, the conundrum that Joe Schmidt and whoever else coaches Carter into the future is going to have around his goal kicking and then what he offers elsewhere around the park, which is a hell of a lot. He reads the game so well, not just that intercept clearly, but the try that he laid off for Kellaway coming back down the short side. His own other five-pointer, they're drifting in behind some runners in front of him. But how you miss that conversion from there, from point-blank range and hit the post, and it's got to be a concern. I don't think you can pick him. And this is what I wrote today, that even though Andrew Kellaway had that slight injury at the start of the World Cup last year, that I think he was then fit for Fiji. But by making a decision to, I guess, include another goal kicker elsewhere, you're making two decisions for one position, if that makes sense. Two selection decisions around one position. And the form that Andrew Kellaway was certainly showed the other night, they combined brilliantly, by the way, too. And you can see that they actually really enjoy playing with each other and understand what the other is going to do. But if we fast forward again just a little bit towards later in the year, I don't think Joe Schmidt would do that. I just it was foolish for me last year. And unless Carter can really start to bring up that goal-kicking percentage, we know he didn't kick a lot last year because Reece Hodge was in that Rebels team, but he's clearly got the duties this year. Gave them away to Jake Strawn there after Proctor had gone off, and Strawn kicked 3 out of 3. Not the toughest shots in the world, I think, but was still perfect. But it just said a lot to me, that missed conversion. I don't know what your thoughts are on it or moving forward, but it's a real head-scratcher just because he offers so much elsewhere around the paddock.
Yeah, I think you summed it up well on Friday night when you said it's been a wild couple of minutes for Carter Gordon in a tweet, and then I thought you summed it up really well today in your story. I did browse ESPN's website because I was looking for some match stats from the Brumbies' defensive efforts, and I thought you nailed it. It was a great point to hone in on, and I agree. I think it's really difficult to pick a Carter Gordon if you don't have a goal kicking 9 or 15 or wherever else it is, because at the moment he's got a lot of work to do with his goal kicking. He was the exact same position as a week earlier almost. It might have been 10 metres closer to the post because, or was it a penalty that he missed the previous week?
Yeah, to the left.
Yeah, to the left again. So he's clearly pulling it a little bit. But yeah, I agree. He must be spooked. And you do scratch your head thinking, how is he Australia's first choice goal kicker at times last year? I think that Carter Gordon, he did show that he's mentally stronger than perhaps one or two things look like, because the way that he responded, his decision to have that intercept, that shows a guy that does in fact have what it takes to succeed, I think. And this can all help his resilience. That's why I thought it was so crucial that the Rebels won that game on the weekend. His confidence, perhaps more than anyone else's in that side, is because he's a really promising player at the moment that's still at the moment without a contract next year. He'll pick up one in Australia. It just depends on what price that he and his manager are trying to get for him. But yeah, big, big moment. Joe Schmidt will have watched that, won't he? When you're comparing a Tate Edmund, who was perfect, kicked really well, kicked from the sideline, competent goal kicker. You compare him to other 10s across the country. Noah Lolasio generally is striping them really well at the moment too. That's a consideration. And And it's definitely one that Joe Schmidt would have written down in his notebook.
I look at Nsoloukai Loto, just 16 tough carries. He's not a flashy player, is he? But I think there was a hell of a lot to like about his game the other night.
Do you think he's running a little bit lower with his body height? Because I agree, he played really, really well. His work rate was strong, and obviously he's effective in the line out too.
Yeah, I think certainly on some occasions, Christian, it's probably the exposure of Northern Hemisphere, right? If you run upright up there, you're going to get pinged on those heavier pitches where perhaps you can't generate that foot speed across the turf. So, pairing him, you know, with any, with a, say, a Nick Frost, who is that athletic lock, if you can kind of come up with that nice blend in your second row pairing, I think it's going to be advantageous later in the year. So great to see him back. Killaway, we mentioned as well, just the way he ran onto that ball for that first try and opened up the force, I thought was a real throwback to his schoolboy days where he just absolutely used to shred defences left, right and centre.
Yeah, and a shout out to Jake Strawn. You may have mentioned his name earlier. He was excellent, I think, off the bench. And a guy that had come from the Western Force last year, he had that really sickening injury when Lachie Swinton copped him really high from a late kick.
Yes.
And
yeah.
And I thought Strawn was excellent off the bench. The Rebels, they've got an embarrassment of riches in that front row. You look at what they had in their runners' side, their B team on the weekend, and you've got Pone Farmasili, who's Caboose Iloff, that aren't even fight in that match, day 23, and you consider where some of the other prop stocks are across the country. That's a really strong position for the Rebels the longer this season can go. It's just around, can that Rebels group stay tight together over the next couple of weeks? And that's what's really crucial against Moana Pacifica this weekend.
If we just dig into that point a little bit more, mate, and there's obviously a conversation going on with the Rebels at the moment, how Super Rugby might look going forward. And you look at that Rebels squad around, now we know perhaps half those players might end up overseas. But say, you know, a Salakai Loto suddenly ends up at the Waratahs, who are probably a little bit light at second row stocks. The props that you mentioned, you know, one to the Reds, one to the Force, one of the Waratahs, maybe. We know Andrew Kellaway's already coming back to the Waratahs next year. And what a back three that's going to be, with some spares as well coming off the bench, clearly. Carter Gordon, where does he land? And suddenly you've got these guys adding depth. And we know that that's so often where Australian teams run into trouble later in the season, deep into games in the second half in particular. And you just saw that Hurricanes team on the weekend just had that little bit more size and strength and power coming off the bench. So with these guys filtering out potentially for next year, and there's still a lot of water to go under the bridge clearly yet, but it would just make those four franchises, I think, just that little bit stronger, add that depth to the squad and really start to improve the strength and depth of those benches in particular.
Yeah, you've nailed it there, because for the first time in a long time, we're noticing New Zealand, the Crusaders, for instance. It's some of those Kiwi sides are the ones that have copped a few more injuries to start this year. And generally speaking, we're talking about the Aussie sides in that position, but you've nailed it. And that's why it's crucial that RA act on this as soon and swiftly as possible. They need to have their ducks in a row. If there's not going to be five sides in the competition next year, and if there are, I wonder how many Rebels players are going to be left, but they've got to ensure that they don't lose too many for what you're talking about. But, you know, sides in the NPC, New Zealand teams, we know that they've suffered a bit of a player exodus in the last year or two. Even guys that didn't make the squad last year, like a George Bridge, for instance, those that were in the All Blacks mix a couple of years ago, they're no longer at the Crusaders. They're now up north playing in the Northern Hemisphere. So some of these Kiwi sides are looking at trying to repatriate some guys that might have New Zealand blood, that might have already come through that system, the Equizanis of the world. Even David Fili, who I think his name is, the inside centre. What a lovely little kick that he put in for Felipe Downer-Gunu to run onto. We know Josh Kemeny's already off. He's a guy who's 24, 25, couple of tested experience. They're the sorts of players you want to keep in Australia. We know that there could be some legal issues in the background with the Rebels. They're going to do everything they can to stay in the comp. with at the end of the day, I think Australia would be stronger with four sides. I think that's kind of been shown and will be proven. But you're right, like some of the guys that you made mention before, but even the Matt Gibbons of the world, the Josh Canhams of the world, you know, they're guys that Australian rugby can't afford to lose. They've got to go to Tars, Reds. Both those sides have struggled in the tight five, particularly in the second row for a few years. The Tars have been having makeshift sixes playing the second row ever since Will Skelton and Jacques Poitguita, who was himself floated between the second row and the six, for 5, 6, 7 years. And it's no wonder when it comes to test footy, Australian rugby struggles a little bit because they lose that physicality battle too often.
Yes, certainly watch this space moving forward. Mate, what else? I think, as we said, we'll give Minor a shout-out. They certainly look like a different team under Tano and Munger this year, which is great for the competition. We've already spoken about their future moving forward. Could also be in some jeopardy. The report last week with the Jaguares, the Jags, what do you want to call them, back from a few years ago, it certainly feels like next year would be a long shot, but there have been some initial discussions around 2026. How much do you read into them, mate? Do you foresee this as a likely occurrence that they will be back? And it's not a bad television slot, is it? Because it's that Sunday morning, sort of that 8 or 10 o'clock, depending on whether it's an afternoon or an evening game, I think. But there is a significant cost involved with flying probably 30 players and staff across to South America, putting them up for the best part of a week. Business class, of course. This adds up for a competition, not just Rugby Australia, New Zealand Rugby as well. Their Silver Lake money hasn't actually turned into rivers of gold. They're certainly burning through it quite quickly, as a New Zealand Herald article revealed last month. This is it the smartest decision? The Jags, I don't know, are they going to bring in a significant influx of broadcast dollar from ESPN? Probably, because we do have the rights in South America. So I was surprised to see that, but I've got my doubts around, is it a strategic play?
Yeah, shout out to our Argentinian listeners. I'm sure there's bucket loads of them, but yeah, good points that you made. Liam Napier, who wrote a story last week for the New Zealand Herald off the back of speaking to Mark Robinson, the NZR boss, he's a guy who's really well informed, and you should, generally speaking, trust his sources because he's a good journo. I agree. I think it is a long shot, but it would have to be on the table. The thing that's worth considering here is that Argentina are a part of SANZA. And when Super Rugby went its own way, Argentina were really disappointed because they went, what's left with us? So there has been, particularly Australia in recent years, had been wondering, what can we do with Argentina? Now, that might have changed a little bit with the departure of Hamish McLennan, but I wouldn't be surprised if they come back maybe in 26. I made the point last week when I was speaking to Catherine Murphy as well, that what happens with the United States and Canada, two sides, it's two nations that are looking for potential new teams ahead of the World Cup in 2031 and 33 with the women. So, yeah, I think all options are still on the table at the moment. And they've got they're speaking to McKinsey at the moment, a consulting firm, is Rugby Australia, around what are some of the best things for the game? What are some strategies? How do we get this game earning more money? Because at the moment, everything, the turning, all the decisions, it's adding up. And there's not much money left in the bank anywhere. So big decisions to come over the next 12 months, but even 6 months with broadcast deals up very close. New Zealand will be slightly ahead of Australia in this time frame, I think. But yeah, I don't know if I love the idea of the Jaguars coming back soon, because I just think that teams need more home games. Australia's franchise is getting 7 and 8 home games a year. It's not enough. They need a minimum of 9 to start to not just break even, but for sides like the Reds, who have Ballymore up their sleeve, to start to generate a bit more of a profit. So I would love to see a home and away game right across the competition. It would allow for it would allow for 9 to 10 home games a year. That's really, really important, I think, going forward.
Yeah, it certainly would help the bottom lines of however many teams. And if 10 is the way to go, that full 18 game regular season, regular season draws. What I'm looking for would certainly, I'm sure, please a lot of the Super Rugby CEOs moving forward. And as we say, hopefully there'll be some big crowds in both Sydney and Brisbane this weekend, given what the two teams have done and shown so far. Mate, all right, I don't got too much else down. The Sevens wrapping up this morning from LA, the girls, the women being beaten in a final, tackling an issue again, another head-on-head for Madison Levi, who I can sympathise with because she's quite tall and I think even did dip on this occasion and was only a yellow, but certainly a great article. It's written by Britt Mitchell interviewing Tim Walsh last week on ESPN. If you haven't seen it, go and give it a read around, that he acknowledges there is an issue there. There is some technique and some bad habits, I think he termed them, that need to be corrected there because it's certainly looking like, if all things are equal on the day, that it's going to be Australia and New Zealand in that gold medal game. And that you cannot be playing the Black Ferns Sevens player down.
No, you're right. And 29-12, I think it was, might have been 29-14 full-time today. It was one of those games where, once again, Australia, I think, not only is the head-eye issues something that would hurt them come Paris, but they need to be a bit more direct, run their running out from their own 22 at times. I think that they've got such an amazing skill set. They play with such great wit. But at times, you've got to go straight. You've got to play teams through the middle. And when they're playing against physical sides like the United States and France at times, we saw them get troubled in a really, really enjoyable pool match on Saturday. The only times that they struggle really is when they lose that physical battle when they try to play with wits. So they've just got to be a bit more direct at times. And that's people like Shani Smale. Yes, thank you very much. Running more direct, giving her the hands, giving her the ball. But nonetheless, it's a pretty good result for them. The men also played quite well. They topped their pool, but then they were shocked in the quarterfinal against Great Britain, who went on to make the final, lost against Angel Dupont's French team 21-0. But it was a step forward off the back of a bit of a disaster in Vancouver. Still no Michael Hooper.
So, yeah, time is fast running out for Hoops, right?
Yeah, you'd have to say that. I think he will be given an opportunity, perhaps Hong Kong. What better stage to make your return to the Aussie Sevens team? A while between drinks, but you look at how Dupont has taken to Sevens, duck to water. It's no real surprise. He's been phenomenal. Can Hooper have the same impact? Very different players, but I think that Hooper can still make a really positive contribution. The guys that I want to see in that Sevens environment, Corey Toole, and I think that there's a place. It's a shame that Fraser McWright, there's going to be a bit of a clash with the Wallabies. He would be superb, another one there, but Dabby Lancaster, The men are still a roughie. They're still within a sniff of being on the podium in Paris, I think.
Just before we wrap up, are we going to see this Rugby Australia review from last year into the Wallabies World Cup? As we discussed late last year, it wasn't exactly independent. Although certainly that was my feelings on it. I know you had a slightly different look at it. But, is it ever going to see the public light of day?
Oh, not everything, quite, and hopefully it gets leaked because we need to find out more about this. So we know that the reviews, there's been 1,000 of them over the last 15 years. How much do you actually really get out of it? We know that already a head coach, a director of high performance was appointed really before these recommendations took place. When is it going to see the light of the day? When are we going to hear about it? Probably this week. We know that Joe Schmidt, Peter Horn officially started only a few days ago.
Yep.
It kind of blows my mind that that was the case. But I would imagine in the next couple of days we'll hear a little bit more about it and we'll get a lot of people from Rugby Australia dancing around the issues, not wanting to talk about numbers, because at the end of the day, it doesn't reflect well on them. And who were the people in charge? Guys like Phil Wall. Yes, he only took over midway through last year, but you can't quite escape the fact that he, Dan Herbert, were part of the Rugby Australia board for quite a few years, and certainly must take some responsibility for the World Cup blowout that occurred last year, and of course the failed campaign. But yeah, watch this space over the next couple of days on that one.
Yeah, the money spent to have people give their feedback to Eddie Jones and then be shut down or told that no, that wasn't going to be happening. Probably not the best way to spend the little money that you do have or have borrowed, as is the case now. Anyway, we will wait with bated breath to at least see something on that later this week. All right, mate, thank you for your time once again. I think a weekend that, you know, kind of rekindled the little bit of love for Super Rugby again. Hopefully that continues over the next few weeks. Some further Trans-Tasman wins for Australia potentially this weekend. Certainly the Waratahs need to back up their win, and the Reds will be eager to bounce back from their defeat against the Red Hot Chiefs, so that might be tough.
Yeah, tell me before we go, where do you want Super Round played next year?
Look, selfishly, I think it would work in Sydney because there are a hell of a lot of Kiwis here. We know that the Kiwi Super Games are often well attended here. I think it's an attractive place for Kiwis to travel to at this time of year as well. You know, do a bit of promo, a bit of marketing around Bondi and getting into the water to Manly, sort of wherever here on the Northern Beaches. If it's going to go to New Zealand, then I think, you know, Auckland could work. I'm not enamoured with Eden Park. I think Wellington probably offers something because of just how popular the Sevens was back there during the day. The ability, unlike you can kind of walk from Eden, from the centre of Auckland, does take about 40 minutes, where it's probably only 10 or 15 minutes from the heart of Wellington up over the train line there and into Sky Stadium. So, yeah, give me Wellington or Sydney, and I'd be pretty happy.
Yeah, I'm with you there. If it's not going to be in Fiji for reasons that we've kind of already touched upon, I think Sydney would be a great shout. They're not hosting the Sydney Sevens at the moment. Perth, having taken that, would be surprised if New South Wales Destination wouldn't put in some money for it. And in addition, with the AFL and the NRL not starting yet, an early Super Round, I think, just makes complete sense. It would be great. Wellington also would be really awesome, and you just had to see some of the scenes and the cricket, and I haven't been to Wellington myself, but it looks like a lovely place to get to, so I'm sure that there would be some Aussies that would venture over the ditch too if they were allowed in, but Sydney, I think, would be a great shout.
It'd be an interesting flight in to Wellington if the wind is up, let me tell you. I've had the wobbles there once or twice before. All right, mate, thank you. We'll see you again all in 7 days. Until then, enjoy the rugby. We'll talk to you soon. Cheers.
Bye.